So chapter 2 deals with innate behavior systems. Now, before we get into this, I want to talk just a little bit about behavior systems in general and what we're going to call complexity. And this is something I'd like you to think about as we go through the course and as we take a look at different behaviors and the sorts of learning that are involved in these. Now, remember, as comparative psychologists, behavioral psychologists, we tend to operate at that level of behavior. And behaviors can end up looking very complicated. There may seem to be a lot of variables that are involved in producing something. Perhaps that, you know, we think there may be a lot of background learning that has occurred, complex neurophysiological systems that may be involved. So we see the end point. What we try to do then is reduce that endpoint behavior through reductionism down to some underlying processes that might be involved. These are what we might call the constituent elements of the behavioral process there. One of the things that's very interesting is over the last 25 years, there's increasing amounts of evidence that show that in many cases, what seem like very complex behavioral outcomes can actually be regulated by a relatively small number of simple systems interacting. The complexity behavior comes out of these simple systems that interact. So complexity comes out of this. The genome, our genes. I mean, a gene is actually in and of itself a very simple simple molecular system. It just codes for proteins. But these simple little proteins coming together produce very complicated endpoints. In a way, it's often I find very regrettable that nobody really seems to teach Gestalt psychology theory anymore, prevalent through the 30s and 1930s, 1950s. But the idea behind Gestalt psychology was that if they were ever going to make a T-shirt about it, you're going to put your field, sort of your theories, slogan on a T-shirt, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And this is a nice little buzzword for this issue of complexity in behavioral systems. We reduce it down to these, we can look for these constituent elements, and many of them are actually very, very simplistic in their form, but when they start interacting, we get complex outcomes. It's more than you might predict just from looking at these little individual components. So, keep this in mind as we go through the course, not just with what we're going to be talking about today in terms of innate systems, but think about this as we go, and think as well as we go through and look at various theories in the course as we progress, theories of classical conditioning, theories of operant conditioning, and we'll often see that the theories that we've got don't always do a great job of explaining all of the particulars we see in the behavior. Now, that may be because there's some underlying problems or flaws with the theories, or it may just be that maybe we're missing a few of these little constituent elements in there, and in some cases they interact in a way that seems to be more complex, or it puts a little bit of a spin on the model or the theory or the way it's supposed to work. So just keep this in mind as we go. All right, so as I said, this chapter takes us into looking at some specifics of innate behavioral systems. So, now, why bother? Comparative psychology, learning course, innate systems, that's that kind of ethology thing. Isn't that just kind of like a biological sciences kind of thing to do? Well, yeah, I mean, in part, sure. But our innate systems are evolved systems. Many of our learned behaviors actually have their roots in innate. So, I mean, classical conditioning, right? You've got to have a reflex system. If you don't have a reflex, you don't have classical conditioning, right? We are pairing a neutral stimulus with something that produces a reflex response. And given that, it's probably a good idea to have some understanding of how those reflexive systems actually work, since we're going to eventually get to the classical conditioning material here. There are many parallels between learned and innate behavioral systems, and when we look at the various theories or explanations for the behavior, we will see commonalities, similarities, between how these innate systems work and how the systems that have much more complex learning components to them also work. So starting, again, this kind of the reductionism approach here of science, start with something a little bit more basic before working up to the more complex. As well, we tend to call these things innate behaviors, and in part there is just a historical component to this where you go back into the early, you go back to Descartes, actually, and the idea that there's these involuntary, very fixed behaviors and they don't change, and this still seemed to be fairly prevalent in the modern scientific literature, the behavioral literature through a good part of the 20th century, feeling that these innate systems were hardwired, they're predisposed, they're non-modifiable. However, more recently, there's a growing recognition that these innate systems do allow for modification. Innate systems can, in fact, adapt to environmental parameters to change under certain circumstances. So some of these systems are actually modifiable. They are not entirely hardwired. We're going to take a look at a number of different processes here. We're going to take a look at some issues of homeostasis. We're going to take a look at some reflexes, tropisms, modal action patterns, reaction chains, and then we're going to talk about some issues of habituation sensitization, which are not innate in that sense. They're the simplest forms of learning, but in some respects, their habituation sensitization are sort of this bridge between these innate systems and the more complex classical and operant learning processes. Okay. I just need to sort of quickly bring in a term here to think about. Elicited behaviors. All right. Behaviors that occur in reaction to an environmental stimulus, either internal or external, are what we call elicited behaviors. Okay, so see something moving in the periphery of your vision, you orient towards it. It's called a flicker fusion effect. Okay, so stimulus, orientation. That's an elicited behavior. Okay. Sneezing. If you inhale some dust or, you know, a bug or, you know, a gerbil, hopefully not a gerbil. I don't know what you'd be doing to inhale a gerbil. It's probably something we don't need to know. Anyways, you know, dust bunny maybe, you know, under your bed sweeping or something, you know, dust bunny. Again, elicited behavior. You just didn't sneeze for no reason. I mean, it may seem like you're sneezing for no reason. Right? Ever have those cases where you just suddenly get sneezing jags and you sneeze away for a bit? And it's very unfortunate what happens to me when I'm teaching, you know, spraying coffee everywhere as I sneeze out stuff up my nose. And I mean, it may not seem like anything caused that, but it's going to have been elicited by something. You know, something that, you know, I inhaled something that doesn't cross a sensory threshold for my conscious abilities to process, but somewhere in there, my nasal passages, some neuron's been activated that has elicited this sneezing response, reflexive response there. Okay, so think about that as well. Homeostasis. Homeostasis is a term dealing with, insofar as we're interested in this, the internal balance of the body. You're this very complicated physiological system. Okay, you're very much a biological machine. And to keep functioning efficiently and effectively, you need to maintain bodily regulation, bodily homeostasis of your different systems. This is, in fact, why you have many of the things that behavioral psychologists talk about in terms of drives. Okay, so we talk about Hall's drive reduction theory, we will later in the course, the idea that you will engage in operant responses due to drive. So if you're experiencing hunger, you will operantly act to consume food. This reduces the drive. If whatever it is you consume reduces the hunger, we would call that then a reinforcer. Okay, so you have these various drives. And in particular, some drives are regulatory, some are non-regulatory. Regulatory drives maintain the bodily homeostasis. Non-regulatory drives do other things, but they're not involved with bodily homeostasis. So, for example, the sex drive is not what we call a homeostatic drive. It's not a regulatory drive. sex drive is there to pass your genes on. Okay, that's sort of the evolutionary point of things. But not having sex isn't really going to be putting your physiology, your neurophysiology or biological physiology, out of alignment. You don't need to bring that back in with any sort of homeostatic system, although I suspect Tiger Woods may be arguing something about this in the near future. Different area of psychology, shall we say? Okay. Although I suppose we could do behavior modification therapy with Tiger, so every time you go find a new mistress, we'll hit you with one of your golf clubs. Or let your wife do it. That's probably the fairer way to do that. Okay. Take an example. Osmotic homeostasis. So this is a regulatory drive. And by osmotic, we're going to deal here with their concentration of salts in your body. Too few salts in your body, and you've had it. Too many salts in your body, and you've had it. Okay? You've got this relatively narrow window in which you can operate. So, the osmotic homeostasis, the drinking, if you will, drinking drive is involved in regulating your body's water levels, H2O. So, consider, you're at a party or you're at a pub. Ever notice how pubs, bars, they'll very thoughtfully put out things like peanuts or little bowls of pretzels or in Japan, love these guys, edamame, little blanched soybeans with salt on them, very yummy. Okay, so you consume these. It's so nice. They give them to you for free. Isn't that wonderful? Well, what does this do? This increases the salt concentration in your body. You're consuming salts as you do this. These kinds of snacks are typically salty. You know when he puts out unsalted peanuts in a bar? Yeah, here's some free unsalted peanuts. Yeah, thanks. That's okay. Yeah. Right? There's salty stuff. Salty snacks. Okay. So this increases the salt concentration in your body. This is driving you out of your osmotic balance. What's the solution? Well, you're at the party or you're at the pub. You're thirsty. You get thirsty. Okay, so that's by the time you realize you're thirsty, you're already being driven pretty far away from homeostasis. But eventually your body says, hey, I'm thirsty. What should you do? Drink something. Well, what's here at the pub? Beer. So, you know, you order a beer and you drink the beer. Beer does have water in it. So open it up. There you go. You've brought some more water into the system. This dilutes the salt concentrations. Great. Super. You think you must be back in homeostatic osmotic balance here. Well, you perhaps are for a brief period of time, but then your body starts processing the alcohol in the beer. Alcohol is a diuretic, which means it makes you pee. So you get up, you go off to the bathroom, you come back and you realize your beer is empty. You eat some more peanuts while you order another beer. Okay, but you've just been peeing out a bunch of your fluids. And in fact, the diuretic, alcohol, actually increases kidney function. So you're now pulling water out of your bodily systems more rapidly. The kidneys have picked up their speed of filtering your bodily fluids. Okay, so you've peed out some of your fluids, you've eaten some more peanuts, you need, obviously, more to drink, more beer, get a pitcher this time, perhaps, and so on and so on. Now, the peanuts have caused, you know, your salt levels to go up, you drink, this takes them down, but you bring in more alcohol, so you're off to the bathroom again, and you lose even more fluids. And this just continues. And then the next morning, you have the mother of all hangovers. Which, not you guys, I'm sure. I'm sure you never go out to the pubs or someplace and consume to excess, because you, of course, now understand this whole homeostatic osmotic balance thing. So no problems there. But in my youth, you know, for example, I would do this because I had not yet understood this system. So part of the hangover comes from, like, the alcohol poisoning, but a good deal that comes from that you're just massively dehydrated. Okay, you've consumed all this diuretic, you are dehydrated. The solution, well, one solution is don't go to bars, I guess, but I mean, you know, let's be reasonable about this sort of thing. University students are going to continue to go to bars, and that's just part of, not every university student does, that's fine, but for those that do, We need another solution here. We need a behavior modification system that we can apply here, sort of therapy, if you will. Drink water. Oh, I'm not saying don't drink the beer. By all means, drink your beer, eat your peanuts, but get glasses of water to drink as well. So between pitchers, knock down just some water, okay? So in this sense, yeah, you've got your diuretic and your salts. Your diuretic's taking the water out. Your salt intake is bringing your salt levels up. Drink some water. Okay? Just bring that back in. This way, you can hopefully, I mean, you might still be a bit hungover the next morning, but hopefully we can minimize these sorts of things. What about, ever heard the, you know, next morning, the hair of the dog that bit you? So you go have another beer if you're hungover. Should that work? Right? I mean, think about this here. All that's doing is you're already dehydrated. It's like, I'm going to consume more diuretic. I mean, in the short term, it's like, fluids. So in the very short term, as you pound down that beer first thing in the morning, you know, maybe with an egg in it or something. But anyways, yeah, maybe initially you're feeling okay because you're putting some more fluids in, but then you metabolize the alcohol and just some water there. Okay. Now, that's an example of osmotic homeostasis there. And again, these are innate systems. Your body is wired to deal with this. This all goes on, you know, your homeostatic processes are going on very much without your conscious control here. So, you've evolved what we call control systems. These are little neurophysiological components of you that do particular things. We also use control systems for all kinds of other stuff. A thermostat is a control system, right? You want it to be in the winter, you turn your thermostat up so it's warmer, furnace comes on. Summer, you turn it down as low as you can, or if you've got an air conditioner, you crank that on so it's cooler. Anyways, thermostats are control systems too. Okay, a control system involves a few components. Involves a comparator, which compares stuff, a reference input. This is where you'd like the system to be set at, what you'd like to achieve. An actual input, where are you really? The action system, basically the system that's actually going to try to do the homeostatic balancing. Some output, and that's really the control system. It deals with feedback. Okay, it's a feedback system. Now, in your body, most of these are what we call closed-loop systems. They have information coming in from within the body, and the output goes to other bodily systems. So in terms of maintaining your homeostasis, these are closed-loop feedback systems. I should say there is a response lag, okay? It can take a little while. It's like, we're running out of, consumed a diuretic, we're peeing out too many fluids, we'll need to drink here, get some water in. It takes a little while for that to catch up. Or conversely, you know, we said you drink the beer the next morning, it's like, I feel better. Well, you've just brought some water in. It takes a little bit for your body to start metabolizing the alcohol, so there's a little bit of a lag, but then this drives your control system away from its reference point again. Okay? So keep this in mind. I'm just also going to foreshadow something here. Later on, a few chapters down, we're going to get into what's called bliss point. This involves some theories of operant conditioning and why certain things are reinforcers, why you might make the choices you do in terms of what behaviors you choose to execute. It's called bliss point. Just when we get to that, remember to think back to control systems. Okay? Bliss point is, in a sense, the theory of bliss point in terms of operant responding is, in essence, a control system comparator. But it's operating not, perhaps, at the physiological level quite like this. More, we talk about this theory more at the behavioral level, okay? But, again, we can talk about these here in terms of the innate systems, and then remember those when we get to the more complex ones. Okay, so, blood salinity here. So, in terms of our osmotic systems here. I like pictures a lot. I like having little graphics. I find it easier for me to remember things. So let's say that this is a comparator here. I know it looks sort of like it just looks like a ball with a line cut through it. But consider it to be like a gauge, you know, like a water gauge or a fuel gauge or something like that. Okay. So here's our comparator. Here's our reference input. So for whatever reason, this is, you know, where we would like our blood salinity to be. So our salt concentrations against amount of water we have in our body. All right. There's an actual input. There's going to be sensors out there scattered throughout your body that allow you to actually detect what your current blood salinity is. Okay, we have some sort of neurological way of detecting the blood salinity. And that little green arrow, it's much more bright and vibrant on my screen than on this one up here, but more exciting for me to look at this, I guess, than you. Anyways, looks muddy up there. For the amount of tuition they're charging you guys, you'd really think they could, you know, get better projectors and stuff. But at least this one hasn't been stolen yet. Oh, yeah. Yeah. A few years ago, I walked into teach in a classroom in Torrey. Henry Marshall Torrey. Not Torrey Turtle, Henry Marshall Torrey, walked in, it's got set up, dum-da-dum-da-dum, it's like, huh, nothing's projecting, what's going on? No, console's working, console's, look up, just wires dangling out of the ceiling. Oh yeah, thieves come through in the night, sometimes they actually bring a ladder, other times they just like pile desks up and just like rip these things out of the ceiling, so this one at least hasn't been stolen yet, so there we go. But for a while, some of these projectors were so bad that I was, you know, suggesting that maybe somebody could steal them, or, you know, even the IT staff could claim that they were stolen for insurance purposes and get new stuff. But anyways, moving on. Not that I want to instigate you into an illegal behavioral outcome. Okay, so we got the actual input here. So let's say that our blood salinity is kind of low at this point, well below where we'd like to have you here in terms of your reference. There's going to be some output. Your comparator will make a determination, and based upon where the actual input is with respect to the reference point, we'll tell your body some magical, wonderful way to do something, have some behavioral outcome, and we'll have an action system. I'm just drawing this little sort of arrow that loops back here, but the action system is going to be whatever it is that you do. So whatever the comparator allows as the output there. Okay. So, we're below. Our actual input here was below, well below reference. Comparator assesses this. Output is we need to bring salts in, so eat some peanuts. Okay? And that brings our blood salinity up a bit, but we're still below our reference. So, solution, eat more peanuts. Okay, this brings us, now we've eaten some more peanuts there. May also have been a bit of a lag before, okay, possibly. But we've consumed some more peanuts, and now our actual input is actually above our reference. Now we've actually got a bit too much salt in our blood. It's like, uh-oh, what do? Different output, drink some water. Okay, this drops us back down. We're now a little bit below our reference, and so on and so on. And so, you know, between eating our peanuts and drinking some water, at some point we'll get, you know, relatively close to our reference. The further you are away from your reference, the stronger. So the further your actual input is from the reference input, the stronger the drive. The stronger the regulatory drive is going to be. Now, in terms of subsequent learning, we go through the course, think about this in terms of motivation. Okay, so you've got a rat. The rat could be going through a maze, and at the end of the maze, it could get some food. But if we've just given the rat lunch, the food is probably not a high motivator. And so the rat just sort of like wanders around through the maze for a while, finds a little alley that doesn't go anywhere, lays down, takes a little nap. Okay? If it's not hungry, if the rat is satiated, food is not going to provide a good motivator for performing the behavior. All right? So, in a sense here, the further you are from your reference input, the stronger the motivation to gain, especially in terms of, you know, consumatory appetitive stimuli, reinforcers, let's say, the greater the motivation to actually make the behavioral response. All right. So, comparators there in systems. Now, reflexes. You all got reflexes. Okay. Very nice, beautifully controlled, nicely evolved, lovely little neural systems that do all kinds of snazzy things. Okay, yeah, sneeze was just a reflex there. They're typically stereotypic movement patterns, either of, you know, limbs or whatnot, or eyelids or intercostal muscles that cause you to sneeze or do things like that. So stereotypic movement patterns. They are reliably elicited by appropriate, generally an appropriate stimulus. In some cases, stimuli. But generally, it's going to be a fairly specific stimulus that is going to produce the reflexive response. So, you know, tapping me in the head like that does not cause my knee to jerk. No. If I can do this standing here, but yeah, okay. If I hit the patella, I get a little knee jerk. You can do it yourself, you know, or find the person next to you, whack them in the knee. Just hold still as I get this mallet. No, don't do that. You can try it on yourself on the break, tap yourself in the knee. That's a patella reflex, okay? It's fairly specific. You know, you hit yourself anyplace else, doesn't do anything. One of the smartest guys I knew in junior high school. Sorry, in high school. James Morris. He's now a psychiatrist. A very smart guy. Pissed off the teachers to know it because they're stuff. Yeah. Found him one day just sitting in the hallway, like poking himself places. I said, James, what the heck are you doing? This is the 80s. So ninjas were like big in the early 80s. You know, it was turtles that was ninjas. It's like, well, I've read about this ninja death touch. There's one place in the body, if you touch the person, they'll just suddenly die. Trying to find it. What happens if you do? Oh, yeah. Just so. I guess that would be a reflexive response. You know, if you hit the right point, you're dead. Okay? Right? But so, I mean, reflexes, they're fairly specific. It has to be a fairly specific stimulus to elicit them. And it has to be delivered to an appropriate, you know, terms of the body, appropriate place. Reflexes have survival benefits. They generally help keep you alive. You step on something sharp, your foot comes up. That's, you know, good. It probably minimizes the amount of puncturing of your foot by a sharp, spiky thing on ground. Not a bad thing. Okay. Much of our knowledge, early knowledge of the underlying neural processes of reflexes. Go back to this guy, Charles Sherrington. Interesting guy. Very smart undergraduate student there. But very influenced by physiology. So not a psychologist per se. Late 19th century. So very well trained in physiology here. And he worked with a lot of non-human subjects, but did some of the really significant early work with spinal animals, in particular dogs. These would be dogs that would have surgical severings of the to take out the cognitive control of the motor system. So they're quadriplegic dogs, in essence. So they have no higher cognitive control over their bodily muscular system here. What he'd do then is he'd discovered that even with this severed, even if there's no higher cognitive ability to control the bodily muscular system, the reflex system still works. So if you poke the dog in a paw with a pin, give it a little poke, the paw twitches on its own. Now, that's not due to any sort of conscious control. And so what Sherrington's able to show here is that reflexes, at least in vertebrates, are regulated by systems running through the spinal cord. So even without the brain, that part of the central nervous system, to control the actions, these reflexes can still occur. Now, this is interesting, because before this, I mean, Descartes certainly thought that reflexes were involving brain systems. Pavlov as well. Pavlov's early work really was going on the side of brain. And when he talks about his stimulus substitution theory, when Pavlov talks about the US, the UR, being regions in the brain, so the unconditional response is due to a part of the brain that regulates that response, Pavlov's making the assumption that these reflexes have to involve central nervous system in general, but he thinks brain regions. Consequently, stimulus substitution says the CS comes to substitute for the US by activating, perhaps directly or somehow perhaps indirectly, the actual chunk of brain that produces the unconditional response. Okay, so Sherrington instead is showing that these can actually just go through the spinal cord, that you don't need brain regulation for this. So very significant on that front. I know it seems sad for these dogs to have become quadriplegics here for this, but no other way they could really demonstrate this. He found some interesting things. Threshold. There is a threshold for activation. If the stimulus is too weak, you do not get a reflex. To gain a reflex, you have to cross some stimulus threshold. Once you cross that threshold, reflex will happen. Okay, it's just going to go. But you got to get above a threshold. Second, latency until response. Assuming you've crossed threshold, you've just crossed threshold, so we present the stimulus, there is going to be some latency before the reflex actually occurs. The further above threshold you are, the shorter the latency. So if you just manage to activate the reflex, there's going to be a little bit of a lag, there's going to be a bit of a delay, the reflexive response occurs. If you're well above threshold, that reflex is going to occur more rapidly. Okay, there's less latency. Third, irradiation of response. This has nothing to do with radiation. It's not like exposing them to ultraviolet or ultra radioactive energies or something like that. You know, paralyzed dogs being turned into X-mutant dogs or something like Xavier from X-Men. No, what we're dealing with here is the irradiation means it spreads. The higher, the more intense the eliciting stimulus, the more muscular system gets involved. So at threshold, if we poke the dog's paw twitches out of the way. If it's a more intense poke to the paw, the muscular system, not just of the wrist that moves the paw, but also perhaps the forearm, twitches the whole forearm and paw out of the way. Even more intense, the whole, perhaps, leg, all the musculature of the leg. Even more intense, musculature of the torso also comes involved to try to flip the limb away. Okay, so four very interesting things. First, showing that, again, it doesn't involve brain region. Now, Sherrington's not showing the brain may not come into play. Certainly it can. You can modify reflexes, right? I mean, normally you touch the hot pan on the stove, you jerk back, reflexive. If you can make yourself pick up a flaming hot pan that normally you'd reflexively release, you can override your reflex if you can sort of think yourself through it to begin with. So you've got to cognitively decide, I'm going to pick this up for whatever reason, right? It's about to burn your house down. I don't know. Whatever the reason happens to be, but you can go, yeah, I'm going to do this. There you go. You override the reflex. So Sherrington's not saying that the brain does nothing here. But what he's saying is, though, at minimum, the brain doesn't have to be involved. This can be done just through some sensory and some motor neurons and something in, you know, in some spinal cord. Passes through the spinal cord. Okay. So that threshold for activation, latency, and irradiation. Okay. So in terms of, and this is where we get the reflex arc. Okay, reflex arc. There are two types of reflexive systems we can talk about. What's called monosynaptic and polysynaptic. Monosynaptic reflexes have only one sensory and one motor neuron. There are only two neurons involved here, a sensory and a motor. The sensory connects directly to the motor. These are very, very fast. And monosynaptic reflexive responses, you cannot, well, the brain is really not doing anything about these at all. Okay? I mean, the reflex doesn't activate anything, any higher central nervous system systems. More common are the polysynaptic reflex arcs. This is where we have one or more interneurons connecting sensory and motor neurons together. So this little picture here from your textbook, I blatantly ripped it off from the textbook in complete and total violation of what my agreements, copyright agreements with the textbook are, because I've publicly mounted this onto a website. Take that, Nelson. Oh, geez, I'm recording this, aren't I? Yeah, anyways, they're not going to listen to this. Anyhow, so here's our sensory neuron. Okay, sensory neuron comes into the spinal cord. Here's an interneuron, and then connects up to the motor neuron and back out. There may be multiple interneurons in here, and the interneurons may also be sending connections up to the brain or off to do other things, off to other motor neurons or whatnot. Okay, so polysynaptic, more common. This is the more common system. The interneurons, why do we have interneurons? Well, they let us do processing. Some additional processing, sending, for example, like I said, sending a signal up to the brain so that you can actually do some cognitive processing on things. They also allow some inhibition to go on. So they can be a way of shutting down certain reflexes. So the reflex may happen for a bit, and then some inhibitory systems kick in and turn it off. Okay, after particular times, or they activate some other muscular systems and then turn off the initial one. So very, very interesting. All but the very simplest of reflexes are polysynaptic. So as I said, these are generally the more common here. The patella reflex is actually one of these monosynaptic reflexes. Yeah, as we were doing before, or as I was doing before, none of you seem to want to start whacking your leg in class. I don't know why. I mean, you know, you go to kindergarten in grade one, and you get to take part in class activities, stuff like that, and everyone's excited about it, but we get to university, and it's like, no, I'm not whacking myself in the leg. No, people might look at me funny. If you're all doing it, you're all funny. Okay. Oh, that reminds me. Not the fact that you're all funny, because, you know, so far, none of you are smiling that much. A few of you look real serious here. Does anybody have a problem? I've got a good friend of mine who's a professional dog trainer, trains helper dogs, guard dogs, the whole works. She's in the past told me she'd be willing to come in and do a demo on the operant conditioning techniques used in training. Does anybody have a problem if she came in with a dog, a helper dog? If people do, that's fine, because we won't do it. But if nobody wants to speak out loud about it, you've got a problem, come see me at the break. But I'm going to have to see. I can't promise this, but I thought it might be a really cool chance to see, you know, some issues about the actual application of, you know, how do you actually do this with a real subject as opposed to just the textbooky, and this should work. It didn't work. Yeah, I know. Okay, as I can't promise I can get Carolyn, but I just have to remember to check on that. Okay, so anyways, back to the lecture. Sorry. Patella reflex. So you struck the patella tendon. This stimulates the stretch sensor receptors called the muscle spindles, triggers afferent impulses in the sensory nerve fiber, the femoral nerve leading to the L4 of the spinal cord, and finally the sensory neuron, then synapses directly with the motor neuron, converting these afferent impulses to the quadriceps, So you get whacked here. Okay. Stimulus goes up, goes in, comes back out, and there we go. So it's just a sensory to a motor. And if this works, I hope. Yes. And boom, there it goes. Whoop. So through we are. Okay. So off we go. Anyways. Okay. So, whoops. You need this for walking. Right. There's other things that can stimulate when other parts of the leg move. This causes this to snap out, and yeah, it's in the simplest form. Actually, I cheated a little bit. That animation is actually showing a polysynaptic connection. So I'm cheating a little bit here. There's both. There's a monosynaptic. The very simple one, if you just tap, is going to be a monosynaptic. But there's also a separate. Polysynaptic one, but I couldn't find an animation of just the single one there. They're both involved then in the walking. So once the system gets going, it'll just cause the leg to snap out and go like this. But yeah. Okay. Here's a much more complicated looking reflex system. I am not going to ask you on an exam to try to reconstruct these, all right? These are here for examples, okay? So don't panic about that. The pupillary light reflex, okay? So size of your pupil, okay? The greater the light, the more the pupil contracts. The dimmer the light, the more it expands so that you can actually see. This involves cranial nerves. So it's a reflex involving cranial nerves. You've got two sensory and two motor. And it's this, I mean, just looking at all of this here, this is a very complicated system. That's, we've got sensory fibers, we've got sympathetic fibers, parasympathetic fibers, going all over the place here. So, again, I'm not going to test you on what that looks like, but just keep in mind, this is a reflex arc as well, okay? It's not as nice and neat as the sensory comes into the spinal cord, hits an inner neuron, and pops back out to the motor. But this also constitutes a reflex arc. And, I mean, if you were a neuroscientist, you'd probably go, it's like, that's pretty straightforward, right? Yeah, a few neurons, yeah, okay. A few synapses, yeah, good. Okay, so, anyways. Okay, so those are reflexes. Any thoughts, questions on reflexes? Nope? Okay. Tropisms. Tropisms are orientations or movements of the whole organism. So it's not just like a reaching response or a head-turning response. Whole system has to move around somehow. Initially studied in plants, actually. Botanists were the first to really study tropisms. Heliotropism. Plants tracking the motion of the sun, so either in terms of the flowers moving or the leaves turning to maximize photosynthesis. Now, the botanists very quickly found out that there's no sort of learning going on in plants. They set up things where they put a circular, very nice actually, you put a sunflower in the middle of a circular room, and you put a track around the outside of the room with an artificial light on it. Full spectrum light, and you have the light go around the circumference of the room, and sure enough, the sunflower keeps tracking around, and then what they do is periodically they turn the light off, but they'd have it keep moving at the same, the track keep moving along at the same rate, and they turn it back on, and if the plant had learned, after all these rounds and rounds and rounds, you would expect that the plant will just keep rotating. Even though the light is turned off, it'll keep rotating until the light comes back on. It's going to be lined up again. So it should know where the light's going to end up after a few hours being off. It doesn't happen. The plant just stays wherever the light turned off. So plants don't learn in that sense. Okay. But biologists quickly got involved in tropisms in the 19th century. Jacques Loeb was one of the early famous studiers of tropisms, and Loeb worked with a lot of invertebrates, insects, things like slugs, anemones on in the ocean. So got to spend a lot of time on the seashore doing stuff. Very convenient, I suppose, if you like taking trips to the beach. Okay, there are two forms of subsets of tropisms. There's what's called kinesis, and there's taxis. Kinesis is movement, it's random movement with respect to an eliciting stimulus, or let's just say a stimulus. In kinesis, an organism is able to detect the intensity of a stimulus right where it is, but it lacks the neurological capacity to encode directional information about the stimulus. Taxis, on the other hand, non-random, or perhaps we could say directed, movement with respect to a stimulus. In the case of taxis, the organism has the sensory capacity to actually determine directionality of the stimulus. So if you're hungry, if you're a critter that's hungry and has the ability to detect something about food, let's say, you know, you can smell a burger joint, you know, you can smell the burger on the grill, wherever it happens to be, all right? But all you can tell, you can't tell which direction the smell is coming to, you just tell how intense is the scent of burger being grilled, okay? That would be kinesis. So you just randomly head off in some direction. If the scent is very weak, maybe you head off quickly. And as the scent becomes more and more intense, you perhaps slow down a bit. And hopefully, you know, but you're just going in random directions. You don't really know. The further away you get, the less intense the scent, the more rapidly you move, the closer you've happened to get, until hopefully, the slower you go, until you hopefully just stumble upon it. Okay. Sort of a random walk process of trying to find a burger joint on campus. Okay. Taxis, on the other hand, it's like, yeah, you not only can determine, you know, perhaps the intensity of the stimulus, you can also tell the direction it's coming from, which means you should be able to get there a lot more easily. Now, tropisms are really, you know, we talked about control systems in terms of homeostasis, but the control systems come right back in here. Okay, so tropisms also make use of control systems. Going to look at this in kind of a different way. Has anyone encountered a book by Valentino Breitenberg called Vehicles? No? Okay. Charming little book. Very, very simple, easy read, but lovely sort of theoretical view of how complex systems could evolve. Okay. Let's consider what I call a simple agent. In sort of theoretical biology terms, an agent is anything that can execute some sort of function. I'm going to use simple sort of shapes here. So here's the body of our agent. It's blue, just because. Here's a propulsion system. Could be a flagella. Could be some feet. Could be a slug's foot moving it along. Whatever. We got a propulsion system. It can move somehow. Here's a sensor. Okay, so it's able to detect some sort of sensory phenomena, and it's got a neural connection to our propulsion system. And that connection can either be excitatory or inhibitory. Now, this is a very simple critter, right? I mean, I'm not showing you anything here about, like, you know, if it gets to food, how does it eat the food or anything else. There's, you know, hypothetically some other stuff here, but this is at root what we need here to look at some issues of tropism. If you want, you could think of this as a little robot, if you'd like. You could build this as a little Lego robot very, very easily. Okay. You can have some wheels on the back to drive it along, some sort of perhaps a light sensor at the front, whatnot, direct wiring between it, excitatory and inhibitory. If you got an excitatory stimulus coming in, that's going to cause the propulsion system to go faster. If you've got an inhibitory stimulus, it's going to cause the propulsion system to slow down. Okay? So as I said, this could also be, you know, it could be a little one-celled animal with the flagella spinning around on the back there to move it through the water. Okay? Okay. And, yeah, again, that's the body. Now, movement. One of the things we tend to forget being relatively big is the sort of scalar issues of environment. Ever, I take the bus in the morning, and so, you know, there's apparently a whole bunch of anthills around the bus stop. And, you know, so in the morning, I stand there. I like ants, you know, it's fine. And so I just watch the ants kind of wander around on the pavement. And, you know, you watch an ant go for a while, and you quickly realize that the ant's not going in a particularly straight line. It's kind of going all over the place. And you sort of say, is that because the ant is actually wanting to go all over the place? Or if you look a little bit closer, you realize there's, you know, from our perspective, you know, very, very tiny little pebbles and twigs and stuff down on the ground, little small cracks and whatnot. But from the ant's perspective, these are really quite large. And so when we observe organisms in the environment, most psychologists tend to work with organisms that are smaller than them. So rats or mice or... I worked with water striders. I worked with insects. Done some stuff with tiger beetles, goldfish. Okay, we tend to work with things that are small. You don't get a lot of psychologists that work with really big. Doing the psychology of blue whales. Oh yeah, really? Like nobody does that. There are some psychologists that work with elephants. That's about the biggest thing you'll ever get psychologists working with. I think I've mentioned. I once read an article about somebody doing a maze study with cows. So getting cows to go through mazes. Now, if the environment were perfectly homogeneous, if there was nothing in there, okay, just a nice, imaginary, perfectly smooth plane, if we've got one of our little agents here, if it heads off in a direction, it's just going to go straight. All right? If there's nothing in the environment to bump it or deflect it or whatnot, if its motor system, its propulsion system, is perfectly tuned, if you will, it can make straight lines. All right? But the environment is not perfectly homogeneous. In fact, we live in a very non-homogeneous environment. There may be all kinds of things littered about in the environment that you have to step over or go around or you will bump into. Now, our little simple agent here, let's assume that its sensory system is not designed to pick up these, I don't know what these are, specks of dust, tiny pebbles, whatever they happen to be, it doesn't matter. But let's assume the sensory system is there to detect, heat. So it really has no way of detecting these little things that's in its environment. It's just going to interact with them kind of in the way that a pinball ball bounces off bumpers and whatnot in a pinball game. Again, the ball doesn't know what's there. It's just bouncing off things. So if that were the case, our organism may start out in a straight line and bump into this, which drives it off a little bit of an angle, bumps into that, and off it goes again. Now, in the relatively the same distance here, we've ended up with a different path, and we've ended up with a different, even if all we did was look at the start and stop positions of our homogeneous and non-homogeneous imaginary world, it would seem that our organism is doing something very, very different. Now again, think back to what I was talking about in terms of complexity at the beginning of the course. If we are unaware of these tiny little things in the environment, from our point of view, things that seem entirely insignificant, but on the scale of our little agent here, they may be very significant. If all we see is the behavior, we might look at this and erroneously assume that this critter has some ability, some desire to head off in this direction. in reality, there's no reason why it wanted to make this particular turn and end up pointing at a downwards angle here, taking a few different legs to the journey. It just bounced off stuff. Nor, in this case, does it have the underlying neural architecture to actually detect and avoid the things it's bouncing off of. Okay, so, again, in terms of understanding the behavioral system involved, one needs to be aware of some of the scalar elements. When I worked with water striders, when I did stuff with water striders, something that's very important for water striders, I'm sort of just talking about this off the top of my head, it's not part of any planning in the lecture, but these are little bugs called pond skaters, or my personal favorite is the Texans call them Jesus bugs. Love that, because they walk on water. Right? Sacrilegious, I'm sure, but it's funny. Just like there's a Jesus lizard that runs on water. Not very far, then it sinks, but still. From the point of view of the water striders, they work very much like a rowboat. They've got six legs. The two middle legs are long like oars, and they'll kick one way or the other. Or if they want to go straight ahead, they kick both legs. So it works like a sculling rowboat. But what's really important, down on the scale of the water strider, surface tension becomes massively significant. Right? So, I mean, we don't think about surface tension. Right? If you're sitting in a bathtub or a jacuzzi or a swimming pool, you just get out of it. You just stand up and that's it. The surface tension of the water is insignificant. In other words, the molecular bonds, the molecular attractive forces between the water molecules really don't make any difference to us whatsoever. Gravity does. From the point of view of the water strider, little bug, you know, that big, touching the water just with the tips of its legs, the molecular attractive forces there of water, the surface tension, is much more significant to this bug than the force of gravity. And so when trying to understand the spatial movement of this insect, insects dealing that are on water surfaces or within water, you know, one needs to sort of try to wrap their head around the fact that we've got completely different forces in play here. The behavior then, when we try to understand the behavior, our understanding needs to kind of keep this in mind. Okay, so anyways, think about scalar issues of the environment. Kinesis. So, let's imagine here that we've got up top here a homogeneous environment, and our agent starts here right next to, I don't know, Mr. Sun, okay, or a hotspot. All right, and we've got an excitatory connection. So the hotter it is, the faster the propulsion system is going to go. Okay, now many invertebrates can not handle too much heat. They dry out quickly. If they dry out, they desiccate, they die. So for many of them, they try to get to someplace cooler, or they'd like to be someplace cooler. Biologically, they need to be cooler. In a perfectly homogeneous environment here, now, in this case here, kinesis, all this sensor can detect is how hot is it right here, not where is the heat coming from. Well, in this case, it's coming from right next to our little agent, but we've got an excitatory connection here, so starts out really fast, and then as it gets further and further and further away, there's less stimulation of the sensor, and it slows down, slows down, slows down, slows down, until eventually it gets far enough away from the heat source that the sensor is no longer being stimulated. We're not crossing the threshold, and it stops. If we move the heat source over someplace else, it's going to head off again. Now, in this perfectly homogeneous environment, where there's nothing you can bump into, it's just going to go in a nice straight line. This seems to be very purposeful, very direct. It seems to move quite directly away from our heat source. But, in fact, we know, because of our godlike ability to, one, look in to the architecture of our agent, and two, the fact that we know that we're dealing with kinesis, we know that it's not actually a directed system here at all. But it may look very directed if we don't know how it's actually working. How about a non-homogeneous environment? We'll start it out in exactly the same starting situation here. Sensor can only detect how hot it is right where it is. We've got an excitatory connection. Off it goes. So it goes off very fast. Whacks into this thing. That bumps it off in a different direction. It whacks it off in a different direction. and so on and so on. It's gradually slowing down as it just randomly gets further and further away. And eventually it stops. Now, if you just looked at the path, you know, if we took out all of the little things that are out there, if we just look at the dotted line, this looks much more random. It does not look directed. It seems to be very much like kinesis, what we talk about in terms of kinesis, that it's a non-directed movement pattern with respect to the stimulus. Okay. Now, I've given you a very, very simple agent here that's just got like one single propulsion system. Okay, so like I said, maybe a one-celled animal that's got a single flagella at the tail end. Hey, a sperm! Well, sperm don't actually, you know, do things in quite this way. But there's other, they're trying to get to, you know, Madam Egg, if you will. But but it's got just a flagellus there in that case. Now, in more complex critters, you might have multiple propulsion systems. So like the water striders I worked with, you know, two legs. It's working like a rowboat. Now, I mean, you might say, well, if they both stroke together equally, shouldn't they just go straight forwards? It's like, well, yeah, but maybe they're not perfectly equal. Maybe one leg starts a little bit, you know, higher up than the other, so it gives a slightly longer stroke, so it'll put it on a little bit of an angle, etc., etc. In the case of something that's just got a very simple propulsion system here, though, in terms of the environment, this may look very random. It's like, it doesn't know where it's going, it's just wandering all over the place. How about an only slightly more complicated agent here? Well, here we got two propulsion systems, one on the left, one on the right. Two sensors. Okay? Got the body. Our connections can either be excitatory or inhibitory. How could we possibly get this? Oh, I don't know. Evolutionarily, pretty easy. Some sort of, failed division process early in the growth. Growth of the organism. Okay, it doesn't completely separate. Two of them are fused together. Who knows? Whatever. Mutations cause twice as many propulsion systems to be generated. Whatever. Somehow we get some agent here that's a little bit more complicated here, but not enormously so. Okay? Now, if we've got, let's just say we've got excitatory connections here. So if this sensor now is getting a stronger stimulus, it will create a more excitatory response to this propulsion system. It's going to make this little motor system here operate faster, stronger, more thrust. Now, what happens if you were just pushing more with this propulsion system than this one? Which way are you going to turn? You're going to start shifting to the left. Okay? If, on the other hand, this one's giving a stronger stimulation, you're going to shift up to the right. If they're both equally stimulated, straight ahead. Okay? So, let's consider the case of taxis, you know, in this case here. So, here's a little critter. Excitatory connections. Okay? This stimulus here is getting more is detecting our heat source more strongly than this one. Why? It's just closer. The individual sensor doesn't detect direction, right? But if we have two sensors, they essentially give the ability of direction. One of the two sensors is going to be closer than the other in this orientation. So our sensor on the left side of our little agent here is sending a more excitatory stimulus to the left propulsion system. That's going to cause it to veer off someplace. Whoop, where are you? Yeah, it's going to cause it to veer off in this direction. Okay? So now this is very directed. It's trying to, if it just went straight, it would end up, you know, right next to our heat source here. But this will eventually push it away from our heat source. we might almost ascribe some sort of emotional state to this. This little organism must hate the heat. Doesn't it become easy to infer emotional? It's like it always goes away from the heat. It must hate being around the heat. It's no emotional condition here. It's just some little hardwiring. Now, in fact, the path's not going to be nice and perfectly smooth like that, right? Think about our control system. We talked about the lag, response lag. So, you know, this one says, oh, you know, a little more movement on this side. The other one goes, oh, wait, we're turning away a little bit too much back and forth. There's going to be little wobbles there as the two propulsion systems try to sort of balance themselves out here. One responds, one compensates, back and forth. So you'll probably get a bit of wobble as you go. Ever watched a moth fly? No? Why don't you people get out at all? Butterfly? People like butterflies. Maybe people don't like looking at moths, but, you know, they're pretty in their own right. Whatever. Butterflies? Okay, you like butterflies? Right, fine. Flipping around there, okay, if you got a male butterfly following the pheromone trail of a female butterfly, it's not going to be perfectly straight. It starts flying one way, oh, overcompensates, oh, the other way. You know, wind gust hits it, got to reorient, whatnot. So it's actually going to be a somewhat more messy path. And again, well, you know, I haven't shown you anything about what might be in the environment here, but, you know, presumably there could be other little things out there that it's bumping off of and rolling around and whatnot. So you might get something that does not look like a nice, neat, beautiful, platonically ideal curve. Let's consider a second possibility here. So let's consider a case where we have negative connections, inhibitory connections. All right? So this one, our sensor on the left, is closest. That's sending the greatest inhibition to our motor on the left. It's going to be firing, it's going to be moving, or sending out less thrust than our propulsion system on the right. Consequently, I'm exaggerating this a little bit here, this will, in some way, start actually veering towards the heat source. Stopping at some, you know, maybe drawing a little too close here, we don't know what the thresholds are, but it's going to stop at some point away from the heat source, oriented towards it. Does this critter actually love the heat? Well, again, there's no actual motions in this. It's a little, very simple agent, or, as I said, you could build these out of the robot Lego sets, unless you start thinking your Lego creations have motions there. But the behavior, if all you do is look at the behavior, this very hardwired, innate behavioral system, perhaps it looks like attraction or affection or love. It wants to be near this stimulus. What would this do? Think about this. So we've got same propulsion systems here, but our sensory connections actually cross. The right sensor goes to the left propulsion system. The left sensor goes to the right propulsion system. Let's just have excitatory connectors. So here we got one. And what's going to happen if our heat source is straight ahead? What should it do? Yeah, straight. It should go straight on for it. Okay, right? Both, in this case here, both sensors are being equally stimulated, so they're both excitatory, straight on ahead. All right? In fact, it's actually highly likely to ram into this the stimulus. Closer it gets, the faster it's going to go. It's going to smash into it. You know, if I was talking, whatever, back here about this one, oops, that one there, perhaps hating the heat. Maybe I should have actually called it dislike, because it just tries to avoid it. Maybe it's afraid of the heat. Now this one here, it's going to ram into our heat source. The closer it gets, the faster it's going to go. What if we move it over here?
Yeah, it's gonna head towards the heat source with increasing speed. Right? So even though the heat source has been moved out of the way, and it doesn't have to ram into it just by going straight, it's going to direct its path to smash into it. Yeah, that seems like, you know, maybe that's a better example of hatred. I will kill you, heat source! Boom. Okay. Now, I'm babbling a little bit about emotional states here. But we'll talk next class about John Watson, classical conditioning, early classical conditioning theorist. You all should hopefully remember John Watson from 281 fame, Little Albert stuff. We'll talk about Little Albert as well. But Watson was very opposed to ascribing things like these inferred emotional states. He thought this was problematic for just this kind of reason. He didn't articulate it in this way, but he says, if you just look at a behavior, it's very tempting to call these things, you know, fear or desire or hatred. But he said, they're being controlled. Now, in his case, he was talking about them in terms of learning. He was very much a nurturist, an empiricist, British empiricist in this sense, that this is being derived from learning. Here we're talking about innate systems, but which Watson didn't like dealing with very much. But either way, if you just look at the behavior, and if all you do is look at the behavior and then ascribe some internal condition, you got a risk of getting it wrong, regardless of whether we're using innate systems or learned systems. So this is the kind of thing that Watson really would have, you know, gotten his back up about. But you know what? He's dead, so it doesn't really matter too much anymore. All right. Modal action. Any questions about that? Would that make sense? I mean, I thought a bit about whether I should try to, you know, cover tropisms in this way. It seemed like a bit of an esoteric way to do it. But, yeah. Okay. Zero feedback. Spectacular. In that case, we'll teach the entire classical conditioning system by looking at small agents with simple neural connections. Right. No, we won't do that. Okay, modal action patterns. Originally, ethologists called these fixed action patterns. Over the years, like maybe the last 15, 20 years, there's been a movement to replace them with, instead of calling them fixed action patterns, call them modal action patterns, because they are, to some degree, variable. Early ideas on fixed action patterns seem to suggest that they were pretty much invariant. They would keep going the way they pretty much always did. But over the years, there's been some evidence. At least some of them are somewhat modifiable. Largely strikes me that given the number of other things that we've got very bad terminology for that we've kept, this in part strikes me a little bit as, you know, psychologists getting a bit snippety with the ethologists' terminology and going, well, we know more than you biology types because we study brain and behavior, and so they're variable, so we'll call them modal patterns, not your old fixed things. There's a whole bunch of bad terminology that we keep within. And matter of fact, when we get into some of the stuff on habituation today, you will see some of the bad terminology in the dual process theory. But we haven't changed that yet, but we like trying to, as psychologists, we seem to like changing the terminology of other fields to, I don't know. Anyways, I'm sure social psychologists could say something about that, and one-upmanship and competition. Anyhow, modal action patterns, we'll go with this now. These are typically species-specific. Most commonly, all members, be careful there. There may be male-female differences, or there may be issues of adult-juvenile, but within, you know, the appropriate group of a species, all members of that group, so all adult male stickleback have the following territorial fight response induced by being presented with the red coloration as a modal action pattern. Okay, females don't have it. They do something else. So given that, we say they're species-specific. They're often very state-dependent. So the stickleback aggressive response This is the case where males stickleback in mating season, their tummies get red, they hold territory. Stickleback are little fish. If another male comes into the territory, they see the red tummy and they attack the other male, trying to drive it out of drive the other male out of the territory. Females do not have red tummies and so are never attacked. Male stickleback only attack other male stickleback during mating season. The rest of the time, they do not. So in that sense, state-dependent, this modal action pattern is only going to be occurring during a particular state, mating season. And mating season will be determined by all kinds of things, environmental parameters, temperature of the water, availability of food, these sorts of things, light levels. Okay. A sign stimulus, the stimulus that elicits the modal action pattern or activates it, we call it a sign stimulus, is necessary. Without the sign stimulus, you're not going to get the modal action pattern occurring. What it does is it activates a dedicated neural network, or some people like talking about a module for the modal action pattern. This is sometimes called the innate releasing mechanism. So this dedicated part of the nervous system that causes the modal action pattern, sometimes called an innate releasing mechanism. So the sign stimulus, there's some part of the sensory system that detects the stimulus, connects to our innate releasing mechanism. Once it activates that, boom, off it goes. The inhibition that kept the modal action pattern from activating is now gone, and zoop, off go. It makes that sound as well. Zoop, off goes the modal action. No, it doesn't really. Okay, don't write the word. It goes zoop. You know, don't write that down. It activates the modal action pattern. And the idea here behind this, the idea of the innate releasing mechanism, is that once you release the modal action pattern, you can't really stop it. Okay? So it's going to go to completion in sequence. So once released, off it goes. Okay, so that's the idea here behind the sign stimulus. Activates the innate releasing mechanism. This releases the inhibition that was preventing the modal action pattern from being executed. Once that inhibitory process is taken out, off it goes. And this is used to account for the idea of why it is going to go all the way to completion, even if this is irrelevant. In 281, I give the example of turkey mating. Male turkeys look for the head of a female turkey in the wild. Normally, if you have got a female turkey head, you have got that head attached to a female turkey body. However, get some ethologists or psychologists involved, you get just a female turkey head. You've eaten the body for Thanksgiving, put the head on the stick, put the stick in the ground. Male turkey goes, "Hello, baby." Comes over, starts doing his courtship dance, tries to mate with the disembodied head. Keeps falling over because there's no body there. Get it? No body there? Get it? Yeah. Anyways, it's not great material, okay? I'm just working this up for an act in Vegas. This is what I mean. It continues on whether or not it's relevant, whether or not it's going to be productive. But, I mean, look, as an innate system, as an evolved system, real turkeys that evolved in the real world, if there's a female head, there's going to be a female body. I mean, probably, I'm going to put myself out there and go at least 9 times out of 10, right? Because if something's killed the turkey, a female turkey, it's probably eaten all of it, including the head. It's only we odd humans that waste the heads, right? It's like, oh, you know, you're not eating the head? What's wrong? Brain in there and stuff. Wolves would love to get that. Yeah, okay, go give the head to wolves. Sure. Okay, so, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, this makes a certain amount of sense. You don't need to recognize the whole body of a female turkey. All you need to know is, hey, there's a head. That's enough, because head comes with body, body comes with reproductive organs. That's all you got to have. If the head is still there, you know, looking at you, watching your dance, it's probably going pretty well. If the head hasn't left, the body hasn't left, try to mate with it. Okay. So modal, see, I almost said fixed action patterns. All my past condition. When I learned all this stuff, nobody was talking about modal action patterns. We all call them fixed action patterns. Anyways, so it's going to go to completion. Once activated, it's going to go, even if the actions, you know, in the modal action pattern are not productive. Yeah?
So even if the female turkey decides to like the courtship dance and she leaves, it's the last
thing. He probably, but if the head is gone, then the sign stimulus may be, he'll start the courtship dance, and so he'll do his dance for a bit, if the head's still there, he'll dance some more. If the head's still there, he'll dance some more. If the head goes, at some point he'll sort of complete his steps in his thing, and it's like, oh, she's gone, and won't continue.
And do they learn if they don't?
Not really.
They just
don't. Yeah, they did. Yeah, no, they don't. Turkey males, they're eternally optimistic in this respect. Well, they're not, actually. They're just biologically programmed. See, again, we look at the behavior, go, he just keeps trying. You gotta, you gotta respect that optimism, and this, you know, even though he's the gawkiest kind of, you know, nerd turkey there is, he just keeps trying. It's like, good for him. You go, boy. It's like, no. There's no, you know, it's not like hope is springing eternal in the turkey. He's just hardwired to do this kind of thing. Okay. Modal action patterns. Here's some other examples. The gray-lag goose, this is classic. Gray-lag goose is a classic goose in ethology studies. This is the not this goose, okay. I mean, some other goose, but this species of goose here, used by Lorenz in the famous imprinting. So the goose, the gray-lag goose lays some eggs, get rid of mama goose, and 13 to 16 hours after hatching, the goslings go through an imprinting period, and they imprinted onto Conrad Lorenz, this ethologist. Actually, they imprinted onto his boots, it seems. These things that were moving around in their field of vision, and they treated Conrad Lorenz's big Wellington boots as if it was the mother goose and would follow him all over his research farm. So this is the species of goose. But what I think interested Lorenz and before him Tenbergen, another ethologist in the goose, was this particular modal action pattern behavior. If one of the goose's eggs rolls out of its nest, they build the nests up on sort of little hummocks to keep them from getting wet and keeping the eggs dry so they don't rot and get fungus and whatnot. If one of the eggs falls out or gets displaced, it's going to roll away, and the goose needs to get it back. Lacking opposable thumb, well, lacking hands of any sort, the only way to actually do this is for it to pull it back with its head. So it puts its beak on the far side of the egg and sort of tries to pull it back towards itself. So the sign stimulus is the displaced egg. So, you know, the egg's no longer under the goose's bum. It's rolled off someplace. Oh, you see it. The modal action pattern is this trying to pull it back with the head. So extend the neck, put the beak on the far side of the egg. Blah, 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 blah. Keep doing this. Keep doing this movement back to the nest. Whether or not the egg is still there. You can actually reach out, take the egg out from under the goose's chin, hold it, and the goose will just keep doing it. You go, wait a minute, doesn't the goose see the hand coming out, grab this and take the egg away? Presumably, but again, in nature, you know, in the evolution of the gray-lag goose, there was no ancestral human psychology, you know, no Neanderthal ethologist going, fag take egg from goose, see what happens. No, fag takes egg from goose, eats egg, kills goose, eats goose. Right? Okay, so here's if this works. Come on. Wait, there we go. And wait for the hand. Okay, so that's the behavior. Okay.
keeps doing this. So that would be the case where, you know, how it's supposed to work. Correct. The eggs wobble a bit, so they have to pull around. But it's just gone. It keeps doing it, even though it's been taken away. I mean, you know, it's not like the researcher here is trying to hide his hand doing this. He's, you know, trying to be tricky. It's like, yeah, I'm taking your egg and sitting next to you. There it went. Yeah. We watch this all day. It's the same, like, 32 shots or something. Anyways. So, example there, the modal action pattern, having to go to completion. I'm not exactly sure where that video is from. This may actually be a Lorenz original, done as high-speed pictures as opposed to film, and they've just taken these and strung them together. Probably why it's a bit jerky there. Okay. Now, one of the other interesting things we've discovered with modal action patterns are what are called supernormal stimuli. A supernormal stimulus is an extreme version of the sign stimulus. Might be larger in terms of size, might be larger in terms of, or it might be more colorful, whatever. And individuals show a preference for the supernormal stimulus. Now, if you think about this, consider gray-legged goose. Their eggs are of a certain size. They're of a certain speckliness. Now, the biggest of the eggs, let's say two eggs have rolled out of the nest at once, or the ethologist has displaced two eggs at once, which one should the goose try to get back first? Well, ideally, the bigger. Why? Well, because the bigger egg probably means a bigger gosling inside, more yolk in that particular egg just through random variation, probably going to be healthier, more likely to survive, more likely to be a stronger gosling. Okay, so go for the bigger one. So in this sense, supernormal stimuli, the largest of the sign stimuli, is the one that's probably going to capture the attention most. And generally, this has a very adaptive function or process to it. However, sometimes you can get some odd little detrimental things happening with supernormal stimuli. Initially reported by Gwynn and Rentz in 1983, these Australian male jewel beetles, Julinomorpha becquerelli, they mate with their female, mate with female beetles. The jewel beetles are larger than the males, so they're actually physically bigger than the males. Males would like to mate with, ideally, the largest female they can, because the larger she is, the more eggs she's got, and therefore the more eggs the male is going to be able to fertilize, the more offspring he'll have, the more of his genes he will pass on. The females also have, these are unfortunately not color pictures, but these little sort of striations or bumps here are highly colorful, very metallic, golds or greens or blues or whatnot. And so the larger these little bumps, the shinier they are, the more light that is reflected off them, again, the larger the female is. So that's the female the male should try to mate with. Well, in the 70s and early 80s, a number of Australian beers were being made in stubby bottles. We don't see stubby bottles too much anymore, but little stubbies. And they had, you see them better in these shots here, a number of little sort of bumps, ridges, you know, so you don't drop your beer, mate. Slip out of your hand there when it's wet and frosty to help hold on to it. And Gwynn Ernst reported that these male beetles are attempting to mate with the beer bottle that the Australians were just like tossing out of their cars by the sides of the roads. You know, that's nuts. Why? Well, they think what's happening is that the beer bottles are big. Size is good. They're kind of curved, like the back of the female. They have a lot of color and reflection coming off these little bumps on the bottle. The beer bottle is not a female beetle, but it has the character. You go, Shouldn't the male beetle recognize that this is not a female? How dumb it, it's a beetle. Okay? We're not talking about even Pavlov's dog here, all right? We're not even talking about the turkey that's looking for a head. At least he's going for the head of an actual turkey, okay? Look, think back to what we were doing with our simple little agents. Yeah, set with the tropism. Keep in mind, keep our control system in mind. It could be a very simple, you know, reference input looking for a certain amount of shiny reflection. Hey, actual input, I see shiny reflection. It's big. There you go. Yeah.
So would that just be because the other sensory systems aren't integrated into this? Like, it doesn't smell, obviously it doesn't smell like a female beetle, but it doesn't take that into account.
Right. So is this because the other sensory systems aren't coming in? Apparently. Yeah. Apparently. I mean, you know, these study beer bottles are a relatively new invention of humans. They weren't out there in the environment. For, I mean, these jewel beetles have been around for, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years without any humans in Australia, let alone beer bottles. So, yeah, it worked. The only thing that looked, the only thing that matched the stimulant input requirement was a female jewel beetle. So yeah, apparently there's they're having some trouble. So, you know, Australians need to stop littering, or these poor beetles may go extinct from attempting to mate with beer bottles. What a stupid way to wipe out a species, eh? Killed by beer. All right. Anyways, here's another example of supernormal stimuli. This over here is a cuckoo. This is a reed warbler. There are what are called brood parasites in birds. So things like cuckoos or brown-headed cowbirds. We don't have cuckoos in Alberta, North America, really. But we do have cowbirds. Alberta's got the brown-headed cowbird coming in. Brood parasites are birds that lay their eggs in another species of bird's nests. And so they won't raise, like cuckoos and cowbirds, don't raise their own young. They just leave them. They sneak in, lay an egg in like a reed warbler's nest or some other bird's nest, and take off. The egg is typically a bit larger, typically a bit colored, even more so than the species they're parasitizing. So we've got some supernormal stimuli there. And when the brood parasite hatches, it's bigger. It tends to hatch a little bit earlier than, say, in this case here, the reed warblers. The cuckoos tend to hatch a little bit earlier than the reed warbler eggs, and it's going to be bigger. And so from the reed warbler's perspective, cool, this is a really big offspring. That's the one worth investing in. Second, the cuckoos here are, they're noisier. They have more energetic behavior. They're more forceful in their feed-me begging, and that conveys to the parasitized host parents, this offspring really needs food. It's starving. Must feed it now. And in this way, the brood parasite gets a disproportionately large amount of the food, and perhaps some of the other, it's, you know, quote-unquote adopted siblings, will starve. So it gets the benefits. Okay. So mimicry, sometimes in terms of the supernormal stimuli, in English you might see the term code-breaking. So the parasitizing, the brood parasitizing species have, you know, quote-unquote, broken the code by which, say, the reed warbler interacts with its own offspring. So it's broken the code and inserted a mimic in there. So again, supernormal stimuli. And you can see this is quite absurd. I mean, you know, the cuckoo is, by this point, the juvenile cuckoo is probably, you know, outmasses the adult reed warbler by about 3 times. Right, and it's still, come on, Dad, feed me. Okay, let's take a break here. Why don't you come on back in 10? Okay, and we'll do reaction chains.